Rolly Platt joins me on episode 108. Rolly is a Canadian player who has recorded countless sessions over his 45-year career. He started out playing in a country band, which set the scene for him playing a diverse range of genres throughout that time. Rolly has recorded 1,700 individual session cuts with the numerous bands he has played in, and also various film, TV and commercial jingles. Rolly has recorded his own album in 2017, Inside Out, where he showcases versatility by including a range of different types of songs. Rolly produced and sells the Great Harp War harmonica mute, and later this year he will be releasing a book about his life with the harmonica. This podcast is sponsored by Zeidel Harmonicas. Visit the oldest harmonica factory in the world at www.zeidel1847.com or on Facebook or Instagram at Zeidel Harmonicas. Hello, Rolly Platt, and welcome to the podcast.
Hey, Neil, how are you doing?
I'm good, thank you. Thanks so much for joining. So you're talking to us from Canada, and I believe you're based in Toronto.
I'm just north of Toronto, about an hour north of Toronto. I'm basically from Toronto, but a little north now.
So I've had a few Canadian players on. There seems to be quite a good scene of players in Canada. So Mike Stevens comes to mind, a fantastic player I had on.
Mike. Okay, I love Mike.
Yeah, he's great. Yeah. So So what's the harmonica scene like in Canada then?
We got a big country. It's spread out. Like, I grew up in Toronto, so there was a handful of players when I grew up. There's several out there now. It's not a massive collection of players. Steve Mariner is probably my favorite in the Canadian scene. I don't know if you're familiar with him. Great traditional blues player. He plays like four different instruments, sings, writes, produces. He's just a great player and a great musician on the harmonica, as opposed to just a technical sort of player.
I mean, I'm in the UK, so, you know, we draw our influences of, you know, harmonica from different places. You know, obviously we've got the whole British blues boom thing. So what about Canada? Does that draw on, do you think, from America and, you know, not being so far away from Chicago? Or is that quite a strong influence, do you think?
For sure. Yeah, I would say American influence is probably number one. Although I listened to a lot of John Mayall when I was starting out. My older brother would bring home these various albums and say, listen to this, you know, forcing me to accept his taste and stuff. But he introduced me to a whole bunch of stuff that I never would have even knew was there. And John Mayall was one.
So Toronto's kind of closer to New York, isn't it? So did you delve into the music scene around there?
Yeah, I mean, you'd get bands just coming up. I mean, there was a point later on, you know, when I was sort of well into my career, that they'd bring bands up from Chicago to play Albert's Hall. So you'd see, or the Alma Combo, which was a big club in Toronto. That's where you'd kind of see the big names come in. And then, of course, everything was done through going to the record store, you know.
Yeah. And so what got you started on harmonica then? I think reading that your brother's records you were listening to, and then that sort of, he gave you a harmonica for a present. And
well, I actually bought myself one. Mm-hmm. So it was my older brother. First, he just introduced me into that kind of eclectic stuff. I was listening to rock and, you know, the Beatles, Zeppelin, you know, all the usual things as a teenager. He was bringing home Butterfield, Asleep at the Wheel, Dan Hicks and his Hot Licks, bluegrass stuff, you know, like a real odd collection of artists, not the mainstream. But he played a little bit of harmonica. I mentioned that I'm in the process of finishing a book, and there's a story in there about how he would buy me birthday presents, like come home 2 weeks before my birthday, and he'd say, happy birthday, and it would be an unwrapped album still in the bag from the record store. Mm-hmm. And it would be in a band I've never heard of, like Butterfield or somebody, and he'd say, play it now. Mm-hmm. So I wound up buying myself a harmonica for my birthday, knowing what my brother would get me, which is nothing. Mm-hmm. So I bought myself one and started playing on my 17th birthday as a project to see if I could learn how to play, and that's how it started.
Obviously, Paul Butterfield then was a big influence.
Butterfield was the first one, yeah.
Yeah, which was the first album you got of his?
I had the Double Live album. You know, it was an older brother album kind of thing, and I put it on, and it was, I know now sort of what I was hearing then or not hearing it, but it's, I didn't get it. There was a couple of tunes on there that were sort of more jazz influence, and the solos were a little outside, and I just couldn't get my, it's like, geez, they're just playing all over the place. They're not playing anything proper, you know? Mm-hmm. And suddenly, after a few weeks of forcing myself to sort of listen to some of the tunes, I locked into Drifting and Drifting and Everything's Gonna Be All Right. It moved me, is the best way I can, simplest way I can describe it. It's his playing. I didn't know anything about harmonica. I wasn't playing harmonica. It sounded to me, it had the same level of expression that a rock guitar kind of sound had, that emotional, crying, screaming kind of sound. And that grabbed me. And once I got it. And I loved it.
So you mentioned bluegrass as well. So is that something that, you know, you were trying to play harmonica along with bluegrass? I take it there wasn't any harmonica on these bluegrass records.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, people say, oh, you play a lot of bluegrass. And I always correct them and say, I play along to bluegrass. I'm not a bluegrass player. Like, to me, somebody that plays true bluegrass harmonica would be somebody playing, you know, the intricate melodies with the fiddle and things like that. I mean, I could do some of that, but it's what I liked about bluegrass was just playing fills and solos within it. But it was definitely a big influence on me. The album my brother brought home was the Will the Circle Be Unbroken. It's like the encyclopedia of traditional bluegrass players all on one 3-album collection. I didn't know anything about it. I still don't. I just I just listen to these things and try to find things that I like to play. Jimmy Fadden was on that from the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band, the drummer who plays harmonica. He's not an advanced player by any means. But he had an influence on me of how to approach playing these songs. So, you know, my approach to playing is, you know, you don't have to be, you know, technically advanced and things to make things work. In his simplicity and his technique was there, but he had ideas. Like he just knew what to do in the right spots in the songs. It's very simple, but there's things that I learned from him back then that I still do in songs like that today. You know, very simple chording, little things that just work, right? It's not complicated. Anybody could play it, but it sounds right.
So this path, it took you on a path which, you know, has influenced, you know, what you did the rest of your career, right? Because you played a lot of session work and you played lots of different genres of music in that session work, yeah? So I think you moved into playing a kind of country type band. Was your first band, was it?
That's correct, yes. I was mainly a blues player, but I had this sort of country bluegrassy Charlie McCoy was a big influence on me. That was the other sort of parallel to Butterfield, was listening to Charlie McCoy, the polar opposite, really. But the session work I got in those early days in particular was mostly country. That's just what was being recorded. There wasn't a ton of blues recordings happening, but there was lots of country artists and lots of jingles and commercial work that they wanted that kind of harmonica for. So that it wasn't always that. Like sometimes it was a little more bluesier, blues rock, but it was in that vein. So it the influence that McCoy had on me was paid off very well because of that. I was able to deliver that style, which was a very specific style that they either wanted or they didn't want. When you go in to record, they'll say, you know, we're looking for McCoy, or just do your thing, you know, whatever. But they give you that direction specifically.
And was this around Toronto, this session work?
Yes. Yeah, it was almost all in Toronto. Mm-hmm. In the days when there was many, many studios, it's changed so much. It's I'd say it's sad. I mean, it's just the way things are. Things change. But there were massive studios in Toronto, downtown Toronto, where all the session work was done, with a group of session players that were basically in this group of people. It wasn't a thing where anybody would just get hired. There was a certain sort of collection of session guys that did, 90% of the work. And they did it because of necessity. They did it in those big studios. So it changed over the years with technology.
Yeah, so a lot of recording done at home now, right? The big difference there would be that, you were in Toronto, you were one of the guys that got cold, but now because everything's online, you can pretty much go all around the world, and that local sort of session scene has gone, I guess.
Yeah, it certainly changed. I mean, there's still the networking aspect of it, the people that I'll still get calls from people in Toronto. I'll do it remotely these days. For me, I find it quite comfortable doing it that way. So I'll know people from the scene, from back then or that I've kept in touch with that I'll still get calls for. But I do work for people all over the world now, which is cool.
Going back then to this first band of yours, so you started, I've got here that you started playing professionally 18 months after you started playing, is that right?
Yeah.
Again, yeah, talk to a few people like that. It seems to be quite a rapid road, to getting out and just being able to play, joining a band and going touring with this, the kind of country swing band you were in.
Yeah, I practiced like a madman in the early days. At about a year into playing, I had harps with me everywhere. Like, I'd just carry them around and play all the time. But I would go out, sneak out from school, from high school at night, and go down and see bands play in Toronto. And back then, there was quite a good scene for blues and roots music. And there were six nights a week back then, including when I was playing on for the first many years. It was all six-nighters. So you go see a band at a blues club, they'd start on Monday night and they'd play till Saturday night. And so there was lots of opportunity on any day of the week to go check out these bands. Yeah, so at about a year playing with these bands, soon after that, I ran into somebody me sitting in at a place, and it was Cement City Stompers was the name of the band. It was a country swing band. I was talking to him. He plays steel guitar. I said, maybe we could start a band. And he goes, well, actually, I was thinking maybe you could join our band. It was one of the happiest days of my life. I remember running home, all excited that, telling my mother that I'm in a band now. And I'm sure she was at least as excited as I was. Mm-hmm. That's how it started. We went into the studio, we did a little demo thing, and the next week I was playing full-time, and it's been that way ever since.
And you were touring around with these guys. I think your next band was Matt Manglewood. You started touring across Canada with them, yeah?
Yeah, there was some other bands in between. There was I played with Hawk Walsh, Rick Walsh, the singer from Downchild Blues Band. That was another sort of local influence back then. He had his own band, and we did this, I'll call it a nightmare tour, because it was, it's in the book. That was a strict blues band. That was after Cement City. I also played with a band called Max Mouse and the Gorillas. Which was a really cool original music band, sort of soul R&B, mixture, original material, and a wacky bunch of guys. And touring was for any of those bands except for the tour out west. It was local around Ontario, which Ontario is massive in size. So you're traveling, but it's within the same province kind of thing. And then I moved out east and Minglewood came into the picture at that point.
So, so as you say, you're playing country and on different. There's some blues in there, but reading into it, you had to, adapt to playing harmonica. There wasn't previous harmonica for those parts, yeah. So you're having to find your way into those genres.
Yeah, exactly. And at the time, like if you had asked me what would be the perfect band, I would have thought more blues and, you know, all the stuff that I'm particularly comfortable with. But because of this eclectic bunch of players and songs and things that we did, we played in the country circuit, which back then was fairly traditional around this area. The bands were fairly, you know, a little more straight-laced kind of traditional country kind of thing. And we were doing some of that, but we were doing more country swing and Louis Prima, Sleep at the Wheel stuff, a little more progressive kind of happening stuff, or at least that's how I saw it. But the education I got because of that was totally shaped my playing going forward, because I had to, like you said, I had to adapt to, what do you play in this song? There's not only no harmonica in the original, but there's nobody that's recorded songs like that to even go by, at least nothing I was aware of. And so you wind up trying to find a layer in that music that makes sense with that style. It was around that time in that band that I stopped listening to other harmonica players, not consciously, but I just moved away from that and just sort of started listening to what other instruments did and how I could fit into the music. You know, if I do have any kind of recognizable style at all, that's how that came about. It was from not trying to copy Little Walter or copy, I mean, I did spend a long time, you know, learning Butterfield stuff, and it, I'm sure I sound like I've done that as well. But like I said, I stopped doing that and just listening to, what are the other instruments in this band doing? How can I work with them individually?
Yeah, so great. So you're playing these different bands around, kind of touring and, you know, working professionally. So you did lots of recordings with, you know, with lots of these, and that led on to lots of session work. So, you know, how did the session work come about? Was this mainly with bands recording on as a sideman on lots of albums? And, you know, you also did sort of getting into movie scores and jingles and commercial work, that sort of thing?
It sort of happened the other way around. The first session, if I remember correctly, the first session I did was, I might have been 19, so, you know, maybe playing professionally for a year at the most. The session work back then, because of the closed kind of network of people doing that work, because it's a very specific type of playing, and a lot of, you have to read music, and I was recommended by somebody who saw me, you know, knew the guys in the band, who was one of the guys in that scene. He recommended me, and I got a call to do a beer commercial, a TV commercial for a popular beer here. First of all, I can't read music still to this day, and I don't have a clue of what notes I'm playing or anything else. But back then, I knew even less. Like, I really didn't know anything. I just knew how to play. But I got the call, this great studio, and I don't know anything. And everybody that's involved in these things has done this stuff a million times. And so I would have assumed that I knew that as well, and just kind of left me to figure it out myself. I didn't have a clue, but I pulled it off. They hit record and you start playing, basically. They realized that I can't read music after a while, and I asked a couple of really, really dumb questions, you know, as a 19-year-old kid, about some of the terminology they were using, and they're laughing, because the producer, Sid Kessler, who was a very well-known guy in that industry, basically comes out and says, "Man, I love this kid." He says he doesn't know crap about music, but he can play his ass off. And it was that type of experience. Like, I felt like the hillbilly kid that came in and, you know, doesn't know anything but could play. But that's how it started. Once I got that job, then once they find somebody that can do the job, you're in, right? They don't want to be looking for new people and feeling them out like anything else. So that's how it started. And then most of the recording was for, you know, maybe a country artist. They want harmonica on a couple songs on their record. The recording for albums in bands that I played with, like Minglewood, came later.
When did you start your session? What sort of year is this?
First one would have been 78, 79 maybe.
So you've been doing this for what, getting on for 45 years now?
Yes. I'm starting to get the hang of it, but just barely.
Fantastic. Yeah, so I think you got here that you've done 1,700, you know, session recordings.
Individual cuts, not actual. So I'd be a multimillionaire if I did 1,700 sessions. But I'm a thousandaire. because some sessions were like six songs, you know, out of 10 songs on the record that you play on. Other ones would be one song. Other ones, other recordings might be a 30-second jingle. So just in total, it's at least that much. It's probably more by now, but some big time stuff, some very small time stuff, and everything in between. You don't know till you sort of do the job.
So in the last 45 years, and you've had this kind of combination of doing some session work in the studio and then playing with different bands, as you've mentioned some of them, and playing, being a sideman on various albums. That's how your career's mainly gone, is it?
Yeah, I tell people that, you know, really, I don't know too many people that are in the position of being a sideman harmonica player. When I say sideman, it means being hired by an artist or a band to play in their band, or being a member of a band. So, you know, some bands are more communal where everybody kind of has a say in things. And so, like, Cement City was like that, a couple other bands I was in. And then other bands are where, you know, you're in a band, but it's somebody in particular's band. You know, Matt Minglewood, it's his band, you're a band member, and you're treated properly and everything else, but it's you're still working for somebody else. So my role in those types of things, I feel like it's still, you know, I get to showcase myself, but my real job, fundamentally, if I'm doing it right, is to support him and the performance of the show and the albums and things like that. It's not about me, as opposed to a lot of harmonica players that have their own band, you know, where they're, you know, out there doing their own thing under their name. They're showcasing their own stuff, and they can do whatever they want. They can play as much as they want. They can orchestrate it the way that they want. Most of my 90% of my playing has not been that. It's been in more of the supportive role.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, and you sent me some great clips. So just going through a few, and you've done a song with Susie Vinnick. Song with Rick Fine and Dean McTaggart. So most of these are Canadian bands, are they?
Yes. Yeah. Susie and Rick are been playing with both of them for many years. I mean, that's another example of, they don't look at it like I'm a sideman, but I'm talking sort of philosophically. That's how I approach playing, is my job isn't to necessarily showcase everything I can do. It's to have some of that, but support them.
Here's a word from my sponsor. Looking for a new harmonica, or maybe you just want to replace the reed plates on an existing harp? TheHarmonicaCompany.com is a place to go for all your harmonica needs. They stock a wide range of harmonicas and accessories from all of the major manufacturers, and always ensure that they ship quickly, offer excellent customer service, and are super competitive on price. Go to TheHarmonicaCompany.com and enter the code HAPPYHOUR7 at the checkout to get an additional 7% off the already low prices. Have a question or need advice? Just drop Jonathan a line on sales@theharmonicacompany.com and he'll be happy to help. The discount code and email address are also listed on the podcast page. More around TV and film and jingles. So understand you played on a Bollywood hit called Delhi Belly. So how did you get this one?
Interesting story, actually. I'm at home doing my thing, and I get a call at about 2 in the afternoon. The person on the other end of the line says, "I'm so-and-so, I'm calling from India, and we're looking for you to do a recording for us." He mentioned his name. He said it's for a movie. It's a, you know, big movie. And I'm thinking, really, you know, why would this doesn't sound right or whatever. And I was super busy at the time. I was in the middle of another recording project. And I said, look, I can do it, but it sounds like you need it right away. And he says, yeah, like immediately. And the release of the movie is in a couple of days. And I said, I just can't. And he says, well, Google the name. So he tells me the producer's name or the actor's name. And it's one of those things where you hit the first three letters of the guy's name, and then there's like a million major hits. He's one of the, it's like the Brad Pitt of India and Bollywood. Long story short is I accepted the session and went at it right away, like that afternoon. It was only for one section in the movie that was the climax of the movie, this massive slow motion shootout scene. They just wanted some crazy fast harmonica stuff, and they gave me direction on specific, more ear candy for the scene. Yeah, so I did that, and they actually, if you slow the credits down at the end of the movie, they've actually listed the actual musicians, including myself, in there, which is unusual. Yeah, turned out to be a major motion picture.
Great, and then you've done various jingles as well. You've, for some big names again, for Ford and Chrysler and McDonald's and Budweiser. So yeah, you've got some big ticket ones there.
That's right. I'm almost famous.
Well, great. And so you've obviously managed to, work as a professional musician your whole life, yeah? You've not had to have a day job, have you not, during this time?
There was a period, maybe 15 years ago, where work was slow. I kind of made some lifestyle changes and, wasn't traveling like I was. But at the same time, as in the 90s, early 90s, I think, the economy here at least had tanked, and that affected the club scene. So there was less work. Being a harmonica player, when things slow down like that, you're the first to go. Like, you're not a necessity. So bands were cutting down from 5 pieces to 3 pieces. And long story short is I went to college for a couple of years for not graphic design specifically, but multimedia. Wound up becoming a graphic designer and some web design and things like that. But I was always playing through that. But I did that as sort of my main source of income. And playing kind of went to not seeking it as much as just, doing the work as it came up. Mm-hmm. So I was always playing, but just not as focused on it. And then I fell in love with playing and wanted to do that full time. And so I'm actually, it's come full circle again now.
And I saw a very nice graphic of your name with a sort of harmonica. I take that's your work, your graphic design work. Yeah.
Yeah, it's one cool. Of them,
it's
yeah.
Great you can do that. I'm sure you got some cool stuff for your website and everything. Yeah, always useful.
Yeah.
Getting to some more recent work from you, obviously you carried on recording. You did an album with Wayne Buttery. Blues as blues can get. You've done regular work with Wayne, have you?
Yeah, I knew Wayne was actually from the area where I'm living. We did a show together. That album came together almost spontaneously. We had done a show together as a duo, and somebody floated the idea, you guys should record a CD, and one thing led to another, and we actually did. And Wayne passed away, unfortunately, 3 or 4 years ago, but was a great singer and sweetheart guy that's sort of been around the scene up here for many years. Nice to have done the CD with him.
And then in 2017, I believe, you released your own album, produced by you, called Inside Out. I believe believe it was your son who got you onto getting this one out there.
Yeah, my very young son at the time, or fairly young, said something. We're driving and we were talking about my playing and career, and he just stops and looks at me and he goes, Dad, if you don't do your own CD or start your own band, you're going to regret it. And I stopped and I went, geez, hate when they're right. Yeah, so it was something that I wanted to do myself, but it's cost a lot of money. It's a ton of effort to do it, where you're happy with the results of it. So yeah, that was certainly the catalyst for it.
Yeah, fantastic. So I think you co-wrote 4 of the songs on here, and you've got different styles on here. Well, you've got Somewhere Over the Rainbow, for example. Some kind of rocking blues stuff, some funky stuff. So there's quite a mixture. You wanted to cover your different genres on here.
Exactly. Yeah. I could have done, pick a lane, Rolly, and stuck with a more cohesive album. But I really wanted to do the stuff that I could do, like showcase the stuff. And I don't think there's anything that doesn't work on there, but it's, you certainly wouldn't be able to put it into a category of, this is it's a harmonica album. How about that?
you're pleased you did it then. Your son was right, was he, about that?
He was very right. It was a hard process. I don't play a cording instrument. I don't play guitar or piano or anything. So just even figuring out how to physically write a song, like how to get the ideas down, writing the lyrics was an interesting process that I really enjoyed. Incredibly challenging, but really rewarding if you get it right. But yeah, it was a great experience for sure. My biggest joy, it's great to get compliments from other harmonica players, which is obviously with an album like this, that's a big part of it. But what really sunk in to me was when people who didn't know music at all, like they couldn't tell you who was a good harmonica player, who wasn't, and they were coming up to me and saying they liked the album. We listen to it when we're driving. That to me means a lot, because that to me reaches out way beyond the harmonica world and just to me sounds like it might be just on a more musical end. They just enjoy it.
But so would you do another one? Have you got any plans to do any more?
I get asked that a lot. The answer is I would love to. But I also realized after doing it, in the process of doing it, which I probably knew this already, is that unless you're independently wealthy and the money doesn't matter and you just want to do it, that would be a great reason, just for fun. But I realized that when you do something like this, you really need to have a game plan, if you're going to do a second one especially, of, you know, are you touring? Are you starting your own band? Are you, you know, how are you using this to promote yourself or to, you know, for what end are you doing this? Why are you doing it, basically?
Yeah.
And so, you know, I wouldn't do another one unless I had a clear image in my mind of what I wanted to do after doing it. Like, I'm 66 years old now. You know, as much as I would love to, on the creative end of things, do that, I don't know if I would spend the money and the time to do it with the state of the music business that it is right now, with streaming services and all those things. You know, it's changed a bit over the years.
Well, I think as well, you know, we'll get into this with you shortly as well, but, you know, when you've got some things like YouTube, which you have, and you've got an active channel, and you can put yourself out playing on that, which doesn't then cost you lots of money, right? You don't have to go into a studio and, you know, hire loads of musicians, and you know it's a much easier way, isn't it, of getting yourself out there and you know.
I was going to say that exact thing, that having that outlet, and I mean, for a couple of reasons. One, I can put out I'm sure you'll play one of the YouTube ones where I'm just jamming for 4 minutes straight. You're not going to get too many opportunities to do that in a studio. You certainly won't get it on somebody else's album. And if you did it on your own, you could, you know, but it might cost you many, many thousands of dollars to do it. Like you said, I can do this, you know, in an afternoon and post it on YouTube. It's not the same as doing your own record. It's not the same of all, you know, all the things that go into writing songs and blah, blah, blah. But it is an outlet for my playing. And that's a big part of the motivation to do an album, you know, one way or the other. Unless if you're a songwriter and you're sort of getting pleasure from creating songs or maybe production on the record, you know, other things. But it's strictly as far as harmonica playing, you know. The other thing is this book that I'm doing, I'm actually getting a surprisingly amount of satisfaction in writing this. It, almost like songwriting. It's the same sort of feeling where you're maybe even more personal because you're really getting personal in the book. So that combined with posting the live stuff and, you know, the various other things I do, recording and things, it's fairly satisfying as it is.
Yeah, so let's go into the book now. Tell me, what's the book about?
It's kind of a combination of insights and you know, detailed sort of discussion on how I approach playing. It's not a how-to book, like a step-by-step how I approach all things harmonica. Not even close. It's a conversational sort of look at why I do what I do, where that came from, how I use it in music, you know, improvising, how I approach improvising, my influences, what I've learned as a sideman in particular, like how to work in those environments, which to me is quite different than just, you know, doing your own thing. But surrounding all that and interwoven with it is a ton of stories from the crazy years of traveling on the road and in the studio, some of the crazy things that have happened on recording sessions and all that stuff. But the big takeaway, I guess, is it's done in a very humorous, entertaining way, conversational way.
Great stuff. So how far are you through writing the book now?
I'm near completion. I'm very thrilled to say I'm 90% there. So I'm looking in the next 2.5 months maybe to actually get it in my hands.
Fantastic. Yeah, good stuff. So it might be out then, what, later this year?
Yeah, I'm hoping mid-July. I've got a link on my harmonicamute.com site, pre-sales, if anyone is interested in that.
Fantastic. Yeah, I'll put a link onto that onto the podcast page. So yeah, again, well done for getting that down. How long have you been writing it?
Maybe 8 months.
Okay. Oh, well, pretty good then. Pretty good.
But I've been at it. That's been my entire focus for the past few months, at least.
Great. So for anyone else who might be thinking about writing a book, so, you know, what's the most challenging thing about writing a book?
I mean, I'm not a writer. So, I mean, the first interesting thing that I learned was this is quite a challenge to take on. I had a lot of the stories with my musician friends. We'll sit around and trade stories of road stories and, you know, oh, you remember this? And so, you know, and I tell my wife just sort of, you know, nods her head because she's heard the story like 7 times. So I had a lot of those stories. And the idea was sort of to, you know, put them down on paper. But it was, you know, obviously when you get into my approach to playing and things, I sort of discovered a bit of that through one-on-one lessons when I'm teaching or doing my workshops, that, you know, what I'm saying here could be put into words as well. That's sort of how I teach as well. It's not, you know, what I would call follow the bouncing ball, where it's, you know, play this hole, then play that hole, play, you know, draw, blow. It's more explaining in a more conversational way. Closest comparison I could make would be doing a CD or 2 CDs. Mm-hmm. Because you're writing content. So there's the songwriting aspect where you got to find, geez, I just need a way to say this last line in this to make this song work. You know, in the chorus, I need the last, that's just not working. And then weeks go by and then you come up with it and you change it. And it's like, yes, that makes the song right there. There's the gem in it. There's 100 of those things in the book, if not more. And then there's, you know, once you've recorded your CD, now you have to mix it. So now I'm still in the mixing stage of the book, where I'm over and over again, you know, reading it again and going, I think this should be over here. I need to change this, you know, the edit, you know, a bit of editing. So it's very similar creative process. I talk about that in the book as well, that the way things are the same across different art forms. It's quite striking to me. It was the same way I learned about music through doing graphic design, strangely, like the concepts of design. Once I learned that in a more formal way or more practical way, I started to see music differently because I realized it's exactly the same in music.
Fantastic. Well, I look forward to reading it. Again, I always enjoy reading any book around harmonica, so I'll definitely have a read when it's out, really.
Thank you. You'll get a kick out of it.
Touched on about your some of your YouTube video recordings. So you do one of my favourite songs, which is Little Walter's It Ain't Right.
Well, first challenge was finding a backing track, and there isn't any. Mm-hmm. That I found. So I had to edit a tiny section of Little Walter's version and basically build a backing track from that, just a kind of a loop of everything except him playing, right? The band playing.
Okay. Oh, yeah, that's a good idea. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm with you. Like, that's one of my favorite groups. Like, that's one of my little sandbox tunes, I call them, you know, where I just play to loosen up or to stretch my legs kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know, just like all the videos I do on YouTube, I'll pick a song that I like, start recording. I might do, you know, the first couple of takes, and then I screw something up in the middle. Maybe by the third take, I've got something that works from start to finish. That's the challenge. You get like 2.5-3 minutes into the song. So far, you've done well, and it's like, geez, I got another 40 seconds. I don't want to mess up. You still want to be adventurous in your playing.
Do you always do them in one take, or do you, you know, kind of knit them together different?
It's always one take, yeah.
So it's interesting on the backing tracks, because obviously that's a big challenge for doing these sorts of recordings rather than putting them out on YouTube
right.
and things. So what's really interesting that I've been looking at recently is this ability of AI, which can pull out the separate tracks, you know, the different instruments from a song.
Exactly, yeah.
So I've tried some of these. They're not quite there yet because they sound a little bit muddy, you know, and some songs work right. better than others. If they don't have so many instruments on, for example, then that kind of works better. So, for example, I love this Skylark, which is Wynton Marsalis, just this trumpet player, and he just plays at piano. So it's quite easy on that one to separate the trumpet and piano, and then you can just get the piano, and it sounds fantastic. You've pretty much got just the piano without the trumpet.
Right.
But other things, when there's more layer, you know, more instruments, it's more complicated. But that has got great potential. You know, in a few years' time, I think we'll be able to pretty much be able to extract Little Walter from a record and then just use that his band to play along with.
Yeah, unfortunately for the artist, and that's why I was hesitant saying that, because you really shouldn't be doing that.
Yeah,
you know, it's unfortunate that it's a free for all now, or it's getting to be. It has been for a few years
yeah.
on that level, which is not good. I mean, I try not to go beyond that, but in that case, hopefully he'll forgive me.
Well, there are moral question marks, of course, but in many ways, you know, you might be opening other people up to go and check out Little Walter and the things, right? So it's got its plus sides as well.
Yeah.
Picking on another recording of yours, I understand you have a gold record from doing the Toronto Blue Jays theme song, OK Blue Jays, is this right?
Yeah, that was another interesting call that I got, you know, through the same network of people. They needed me for something, but you don't know what it is until you get there. Very rarely do they get into any details. They just say, we got a session tomorrow morning at 8 in the morning and be there. And it was for the Blue Jays. It's a very hometowny kind of, you know, sweet feel-good song about baseball. They wanted kind of a lighthearted harmonica. And this is, you know, another thing that I talk about is when you go into session work, I would love to just play whatever I wanted and do a great harp feature or whatever, but that's not what they're hiring you for. They have a vision of what they want. They just want your little bit of the harmonica sound in there to give it that vibe. And so that was the case in this. But the funny thing that happened is they had a couple of people from the marketing team, and I played the song, and then there's this line in the song that says, is it a fly ball? Is it a seagull? Because the Blue Jays play near Lake Ontario, so you get birds. Occasionally the birds will actually fly into get hit by a ball, actually. So there's a line in there, is it a seagull? And they said, can you make a sound like a seagull on the harmonica? And I go blank. I've heard of seagulls all my life, as we all have. I couldn't think of how it sounded if you paid me money, which they were. And so I'm trying to come up with something, and they're all like jumping on me like, no, that's not it. It's more like this. And they're making these seagull sounds. And the director of the marketing team is clucking away, like trying to make seagull sounds. And I just stopped for a second and looked and went, this is nuts. These high level musicians and business people all sitting around trying to argue about what a seagull sounds like. And anyway, I wound up playing something that to me sounds like a little baby chick peeping away.
Is that a fly ball, or is it a seagull coming in from the lake?
So yeah, you've won a few awards as well. You've won two double platinum and a Juno award as well, which is a Canadian music award, the Juno, isn't it?
Yeah, I've won the awards as a participant in the project, not as obviously as the artist.
And you mentioned also that you do teaching. You teach at camps.
Yeah.
So yeah, you do plenty of that. And then you've also got quite a few pre-recorded videos available on your website of you doing various things, improvising, playing with a great Carlos Do Junco,
yeah.
The top end, third position. So you've got videos on of you doing teaching material available on your website, yeah?
Yeah, so I was, especially during COVID, I guess is when it started, the workshops, doing two-hour video Zoom workshops. And then I offered them for sale after the fact as well. And they're still up there.
A question I ask each time, Rolly, is if you had 10 minutes to practice, what would you spend those 10 minutes doing?
Jamming, just jamming. That's what I spend my 10 minutes on every day. And it's more than 10 minutes, but it's this stage for me, that's where I grow the most, is when I'll put on that Little Walter song, or I'll put on a bluegrass tune, or I'll put on a shuffle or something, and I just play to the track. I turn it up, I put the headphones on or whatever method I've got to have it nice and loud, and I play hard and I play as creatively as and experimentally as I can possibly come up with. And that's how I find my licks and my ideas. That's the creative sandbox that I'm playing in.
Yeah, great. And I think, you know, a lot of harmonica players learn in that way. But I think what it sort of simulates a performance quite well, I think, doesn't it, if you're playing along like that, jamming along?
Absolutely. I believe you're learning, subconsciously learning a whole bunch of things without even trying. I'm not trying to do a performance. It's a little different when I'm doing my videos because I am trying to get one good version down. When I'm practicing, I'll do a little bit of that, but really every other lick is, if not every lick, is I'm trying to step outside of my box of my comfort zone and experiment. I'll go aiming at notes that I don't normally use. I'll try a timing thing that I've never tried that, you know, I'm not thinking about, but I'm just experimenting with slight variations on the collection of things that I already do. But I'm also learning good time. I'm also learning, you know, fine-tuning my phrasing and my syncopation in the music. That's something that I focus on a lot when I'm playing is phrasing and timing. It's all phrasing and timing as far as I'm concerned. So all those things, you know, that and how to interact with other instruments and different things that are happening in the music, that those are all things that take place while you're jamming, if you're doing it properly, if you're listening.
So we'll move on to the last section now and talk about gear. So first thing for you has to be the hautbois. So you do a trumpet mute, as you also call it, so the harmonica wall, which you made how long ago now, 10 years or so that you first...
Yeah, probably about 8 years now, yeah. You actually did a review on it when it first came out.
That's right, yeah. So I own one of these and indeed wrote a review for the Harmonica UK magazine, Harmonica World. So this kind of emulates playing through a cup or a glass, right? So you're getting that nice wah sound, yeah.
Yeah, that's how I envisioned it. The sound isn't a new idea. The idea of playing into a cup or a can or anything else is not a new idea. I think most harp players have experimented with something like that, as I did. What I discovered was there was actually nothing out there that was anything better than a soup can or a cup or, you know. And I was doing that. It was actually on that Wayne Buttery album that I went to use an actual cup and was banging into the, you know, $2,000 microphone they had. And, you know, I just found it awkward to aim it into a microphone and kind of like, I thought, well, why am I, you know, doing this? It's got to be an easier way to do it. That was a catalyst for the product.
Yeah, exactly. And it's built for the purpose, right? And then the very important thing is the sound comes out the bottom rather than if you're using a cup, obviously it comes out the top and you're not able to sort of capture that on the microphone well, right? So that's a massive advantage straight away.
Yeah, that was the idea for me. It's like an extended version of regular hand cupping. You know, instead of just cupping your other hand, you're cupping the end of the hautbois and using it like in the same way that a trumpet player would use a mute. They don't use them all the time. It's a specific sound. It's an effect. Mm. And so, you know, I remember when I first launched it, people were commenting. Some people would comment that, oh, you know, I use my hands. Well, it's a different A. It's a different sound. And B, it's not meant to be used all the time. It's an effect, you know. It's like an octave pedal. How often do you use an octave pedal? Hopefully not too often, but it's really good when you do.
No, absolutely. And again, in that review I wrote, I remember summarizing it by saying that it's worth getting to have another tool in your arsenal, right? Just to give you that different sound, as you say, to
exactly,
use it on some songs. And it does have a different sound, you know, and you do get a very strong wah sound of it out of it, much stronger than you can get just with your hands. And so what about also the material? Because it's made out of metal. So did you really research the material you used and the sort of sound you were getting from it?
I experimented with different materials, including plastic. I mean, part of it what I learned in that process of designing this and manufacturing it is you've got to work within a budget. You've got to work, you know, you've got to think about how you're going to produce these. Are they made by hand one at a time? No, they're manufactured and all those things. So, you know, I tried a couple of different materials and I found the aluminum resin is very light, which I wanted as well, but fairly strong. And the thickness of it, like if it's too thick, it's maybe more durable or whatever, but it doesn't resonate the same way. It was actually a challenge to get it that thin and still be able to manufacture it the way I designed it. Because of that, it has a nice resonance. Everything has sort of a natural frequency, so there's certain notes that it likes better than others, but you know, that was the process. Yeah,
that's what I found, is it works well in the low notes, doesn't it? You get a beautiful sound at the lower notes. The higher notes, it doesn't resonate so well. But I mean, I guess that's the case with, you know, using anything or your hands, isn't it?
Yeah, so, that's yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's meant for the low end, and it definitely resonates bigger, you know.
Yeah, and you know, visually it's interesting. Yes, and then later on you released a handle.
One of the, you know, when you launch something, for me, it was easy to hold, or I was used to holding it, and some people had trouble holding it without the handle.
Yeah, because it's reasonably large in your hands, isn't it?
It is, yeah. And so I realized that I, you know, didn't have a solution for a while, and then the idea of just putting it, you know, I held up a coffee cup and I went, oh, that has a handle. There's a good idea. So I borrowed that idea. Yeah, it shipped it out, and I think it makes a huge difference because now you literally, that sort of hooks over your fingers. It just hangs there, like you don't even have to hold it. It basically stays in place.
Can you attach the handle to, if you don't have one with a handle?
Yes, you can, yeah.
Okay, well, so we'll move on then. Another thing you have on your website is you have quite a lot of gear reviews, which again is always great to see. I think, you know, we're getting a great player like yourself reviewing some gear and, you know, useful things for harmonica. I think it's always really good to see. So that I'll put a link onto the podcast page of some of the things that you've reviewed on there. So that's a great little section. So talking about harmonica, so you're a Zeidel endorser. Yeah, I think you play the 1847, do you?
Yeah, I started playing them before that happened. Specifically, at the time, I was looking for a harmonica that might last longer, and I kept hearing about the steel reeds, and people would say they last, I don't know, 10 times as long, and other people say, oh, they don't last longer. And eventually, I just said I need to find out for myself and bought I think it was a Session Steel that I started with. I bought a D harp because that's the key that I would burn out the fastest, and I tend to play very hard when I'm playing live. And so that would be the one that I'd go through the quickest. And it lasted way longer. Like, I mean, I had that thing for a long time before anything happened to it. Maybe 5 times as long. The other ones I've had since then, maybe not quite that long. You know, they vary. It depends on the harp and what you're using it for, obviously. So it's hard to judge. But that was the catalyst for buying them. And then a friend of mine who's in the retail harmonica business mentioned to Zeidel that I'm playing them now, and they approached me about an endorsement.
Great stuff, yeah. Do you play any chromatic?
I don't. I own them. Mm-hmm. I've got another one coming, actually, but I don't spend the time on it. It's I need the motivation to. I won't do anything unless I feel I can own it. If I can get good enough at something that I can actually do it on stage, where I feel I'm not screwing things up, then I'm happy. But until I get to that stage, it's hard for me to get into it. You know?
Sure, yeah. And I have got that you do use some different tunings. I've got you using the Todd Parrott tuning, which is the flat 7th tuning on New Orleans Jam. And you also use a country tuning on your Somewhere Over the Rainbow, so you like a few different tunings.
Yeah, both of those came up before I met Todd. I tuned a harp to that, the flat 7, myself, just out of necessity, whatever song I was trying to work on. And I thought, yeah, this is kind of cool. Like, it gives you that flat 3 up in the upper register. It just makes sense for blues stuff. So I would use that occasionally. And then I connected with Todd, and he was sharing that, oh, yeah, you know, it's a thing, you know, I didn't know. The country tuning happened a very similar way, as I really like that tuning because I like both of those tunings because they're simple. I'm not big on trying to learn something new. Again, I feel like I have to own the whole thing, you know, to be able to use it comfortably. But the country tuning came up in a session when I was probably 21, and the steel player on the session says, I just did a recording with McCoy, Charlie McCoy in Nashville last week, and he goes, do you know he tunes his harmonicas? And I'm 21, and I'm like, I'm just learning how to tune them myself. You know, when they go flat, he goes, no, not to fix them. He says he tunes it to a different note. And I go, what? And I said, what note? He goes, well, I don't know. So I went home and ruined about 8 harmonicas tuning up every note possible until I hit, by accident or just process of elimination, the 5 draw, raised the semitone. And as soon as I picked up the harp to try it, I went, there it is. There it is. I didn't know what I was looking for, but I knew it as soon as I heard it.
What about your embouchure? What embouchure do you like to use?
I'm a lip purser, but I use tongue blocking for splits and octaves.
Yeah.
And you'll know when I'm doing it because I play on a slant. So when I'm going straight across, I'm tongue blocking.
Right. I noticed seeing you play that you really do hold the angle and the harmonic on quite an angle. It's almost vertical at times, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I noticed that. Yeah. And so what about amplifiers?
I've had many, currently using a Bassman reissue, an older reissue Bassman. I've got a Gibson Maestro 56, I think, beautiful old Gibson Maestro amp that I use on smaller gigs like duos and trios, and another little tiny custom Trinity amp, which is a Canadian handmade amp.
So I noticed seeing you playing the Greg Heumann Ultimate 58 and 57. So are they the mics you typically use, and then with these tube amps or?
I change. You know, I get bored with something and I'll try something else. I mean, to me, there's no one piece of gear that's right. It's they all do something different. I have the 57, the Ultimate 57 with the little shield on the end, the bulletizer,
yeah,
which I really like. I use that for a long time. I have a bullet mic, a Shure bullet mic, like a vintage one that's been customized, I think with an early 60s element in it that I really like as well. It's heavy as hell, but it's sounds great. But subtle differences in them as far as the mics go.
Yeah, so many amps and many mics, like Elvis, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, and each one works, you know, might work better with a different amp and different situations.
And what about effects? I did notice some effects on, say, one of the videos that you did.
What you're hearing when I'm recording on the videos is I'm going straight into my computer. Everything you're hearing, there's no amplifier involved. It's all software plugins. I like the envelope filter, and I use the one I like now is the Qtron Nano. It's great. It's got all the controls that I want on it, where I can set up the amount of that quack that you get when you play. I use the Sub and Up Mini, I think it's called, a small one, for the octave. Yeah, I mean, all those things to me are less is more. Like, that's why I like being able to dial them in so that it's sensitive, you know, like it's not overkill.
So you do use some effects when you're playing live, obviously using that sub pedal, for example.
Yeah, those two pedals, and I've got a nice reverb. The current one I have is it's called Echoplex. That's the delay. I've got a TC Electronics Hall of Fame, I guess, reverb, which I use less. You know, I kind of tend to go with more of the delay, delay on it, not too heavy.
Yeah, fantastic. And so final question then, just on your future plans. Sounds like it's to finish the book off this year, is it? And
the book is top of mind for sure. It's everything I'm doing right now. I don't have any plans. It'll depend on what happens, you know, after releasing the book. And, you know, I'm probably going to continue doing what I'm doing, which is session work remotely or in person. Teaching, which I'm doing. I have a few one-on-one students. I don't take on too many, but I have a couple. And promoting the product, the Harpois, and playing live with my friends.
So thanks so much for joining me today, Rolly Platt.
Well, thank you.
Once again, thanks to Zidal for sponsoring the podcast. Be sure to check out their great range of harmonicas and products at www.zidal1847.com or on Facebook or Instagram at Zidal Harmonicas. Many thanks to Rolly for joining me today. He has lots of great stories and knowledge on the harmonica, so I'm sure his upcoming book will be a great read. There's a link on the podcast page if you'd like to pre-order a copy, and I'd heartily recommend The Harp War. The link is also on the podcast page. Let's have Rowley Players out now with a song from his Inside Out album, Mad River.